Blog Talk Radio.
Led by your host, Paul Grunion, that's myself, on magical films and films of interest to magicians. Now, also into pagans. And we will start off running by some silent classics, and we'll work our way through all the way through to the latest offering by the Howard Phillips Lovecraft Historical Society. Which is The Whisperer in the Darkness. And now this will not be a detailed history of weird films, but rather it will be a selection of what we consider to be the best and the most interesting. And, we want you to call in if you agree with us or disagree with us, or you got something to suggest or whatever on this subject. So remember, our call in number is 347-857-1830. I'll repeat that. That's 347-857-1830. Now, we're going to discuss some of the old classics, like Cocteau's Orpheus and Orson Welles' Black Magic and Bergman's Seventh Seal. But mainly what we're going to do tonight, because we've done a show like this before last year, it was a little more structured than this, but this time I'm going to talk about my favorites. You got your favorites, because there's an awful lot of films that are of interest in magicians. And so you probably have your favorites, and I have my favorites. But this is going to be, I'm going to talk about my favorites, and if you want to add something to the list, then you call in and tell us about it. Now, let's get on into this. We'll go back to, let's say, 1920. Okay. Dergolem. All right. Now, Dergolem, I think most of you magical field nuts have already seen this, or at least you've seen part of it. It's a marvelous German silent film that is set in the Prague ghetto back in during the Renaissance, and it's very surrealistic as far with the sets. The sets are like that other silent film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which we've all seen aspects of. And the setting in the Prague ghetto, which of course is very narrow streets and twisty kind of weirdly shaped medieval buildings and all, and very, very evocative and very surrealistic. And being a silent film, of course, that covers, gives it that aura of looking back in time. Now, the story, of course, is about Rabbi Lo, who is the patriarch of the Jewish ghetto, and the Jews are being persecuted. So he creates a magical giant out of clay, and he summons the demon Astaroth to instill life into this creature. And so they Gollum comes alive and is a great big imposing looking clay creature. And if you think that this had some influence on Frankenstein, you're probably right, it did. Now, one of the interesting things about this in our history of our little short history of films that we like here is that the man who plays the Gollum is a very interesting actor with a great big heavy set guy with a big jolly face and very piercing eyes by the name of Paul Wegener. And Paul Wegener is the Gollum, and he's very ferocious as the Gollum. Well, of course, you know, the way you get rid of a Gollum. the Gollum has written on his forehead in Hebrew, he has Ameth, which means truth. And if you wipe the Aleph off, you get Meth, and of course Meth means death in Hebrew, and that kills the Gollum. And some of you people who some of you guys that are cooking up anti-histamine pills, you might want to think about that. Meth. Yeah. But anyway, that's the way to kill a Gollum. We had a cartoon in the Seventh Ray sometime back where this one rabbi he's asking the other rabbi for some help, and the other rabbi is buried in the scroll, reading the scroll, and the one rabbi has a leash, and it's going way up off the frame, and there's these huge, gigantic clay feet behind him. And the old rabbi's got his nose in the scroll, says, "Oh, come on, Saul, I told you, just wipe the letter off his forehead." And of course, it's impossible because the thing is, by this time, it's so huge. But anyway, the Gollum is, one of the scenes of the Gollum I really like is up at the top of Rabbi Lowe's tower. The whole tower is shaped like an ancient Canaanite altar. It has those horns at the corners, you know, those just, well, very much like our OTA altar. And this worked the whole film as far as I'm concerned. This strange tower that he has, and he's up on the top of this thing with these horns inside. The tower is an altar. This is a film that you really, if you haven't seen it, you really want to look at it. Now, in 1926, moving right along in the silent era, we have one of my favorite of the silent ones called The Magician. And this is a film by a very celebrated director, writer, screenwriter, director, and producer, Rex Ingram. And he did The Magician in 1926. Now, there's a lot of, we've discussed this before, so I won't spend too much time with it, but The Magician is based upon a novel by the same title by the famous British novelist W. Somerset Maugham. Now, this novel is kind of an anomaly for W. Somerset Maugham, who wrote rather naturalistic material for the most part, but this was a very melodramatic, very romantic novel. And he claims that he went in the British Museum and stayed in there for several weeks and can't even remember all the stuff that he researched, but he certainly did. He really did his homework on this one. And the novel and the film is kind of a send-up in a dark, dramatic sort of way. It's kind of a send-up on Aleister Crowley, because the character, Oliver Haddo, the hypnotic magician in the film, is based upon Aleister Crowley. And but he's far more sinister than Crowley ever was. But Crowley liked the book, and he liked the film. He liked it so much that he used Oliver Haddo later as a pseudonym in The Equinox. But anyway, Rex Ingram wrote a script and did this, and Oliver Haddo hypnotizes and seduces the innocent heroine, and has a real Svengali kind of a thing, and then he gets her off to his wizard's tower down on the Riviera or somewhere, and he's going to take her virgin's blood, and he's going to use it to make a homunculus. You know, he's going to bring this creature to life, but he needs her virgin blood of her heart to do it, which is the kind of a murderous design. So he's a dark black alchemist. Anyway, that's the story. But the tower scene and his laboratory and this tower, and he even has an Igor. He has a little hunchback servant, you know, that helps him and all that. This is the archetype for Whaley's tower in Frankenstein. You will see this when you see this film. You'll know where Frankenstein came in 1933, and you'll know where it came from. But Paul Wegener, the same guy that played the Gollum, he plays Oliver Haddo, and oh boy, does he ever! He is really, really eye rolling evil. And this is one. And by the way, the film's beautifully produced, and the dream sequences in this film are just beautiful. Now, this was not available. The Magician wasn't available until very recently in a decent reproduction. Now we have, and of course you can get it on Amazon like everything else, now you can get a good MGM archive copy of The Magician, which is beautiful print, and you can really see the dream sequences. Oh, it's like that Swedish witchcraft film, which I could mention that one too, but you know, we can't mention them all, but you're familiar with that old film that was made around at the same time called Witchcraft? Well, it had a whole bunch of scenes of witches, sabbats kind of thing. Actually, the one that Rex Ingram did in this Magician is the best of those silent film occult dream sequences. It really is beautiful. Now, let's move on to, and here again, remember, I'm talking about the films that are particularly memorable to me, and I know I'm going to leave out some favorites and whatever and all, but let's move right on to 1935, and Vernon C. Cooper, the guy who produced King Kong, the year following his King Kong production, he did his version of H. Rider Haggard's She. Now, this is a fantasy film, but it's also magical. It's very magical because she is the eternal woman who bathes in the radioactive flame, renews her youth, and she is the ruler of this lost kingdom, lost land of Kor. Now, what Marion C. Cooper did when they did it, did she in 1935? Originally, the story had been set. Kor was an ancient Egyptian city lost in the Sahara Desert. Well, Cooper thought that, well, by this time, 1935, we're flying over the desert all the time, so consequently, let's take Kor and put it somewhere else where it's harder to find. And so he opted for making it a subterranean kingdom up there near the Arctic Circle. He had to go through Siberia and you go through this up this huge cliff and into this cavern, and then you'd find Kor. And, of course, the radioactive fires would come up into her temple, and she'd bathe in them and whatever. So this film, by the way, starred Randolph Scott and Helen Gahagan. And this is something I'm going to mention here about Helen Gahagan was an opera singer and a politician. I think she ran for governor of California at one time and almost won. She was a U.S. senator, And so she really was. She who she who must be obeyed. And you'll see, very, very powerful woman. Oh, boy. And this film is just very, very magical. Now, another reason why I want to mention She is because in 1935, Cooper wanted to do it in Technicolor. And he wanted to. And the whole film was designed to be done in Technicolor, and which was just coming in at that time. But they couldn't. The budget, they ran out. You know, they were running the budget, and at the last minute, they said, oh, okay, well, we can't do it in Technicolor, so they shot it in black and white. Now, knowing this, Ray Harryhausen just recently, in the past 7 years or so, Ray Harryhausen decided that he was going to take the responsibility for colorizing She. Now, you know, there's been a lot of controversy about colorizing old films. For a while there, maybe 15, 20 years ago, they started doing that. And some of their efforts were really bad. And occasionally, I saw, by the way, I did see a very good colorized version of the original King Kong. But that disappeared very quickly. That was good. They did a good job of that one. And Harryhausen, using his prestige and his, being a giant in the film industry as far as special effects and all that's concerned, Harryhausen had enough prestige to where he, and the fact that She was originally intended to be in Technicolor, that he convinced the powers that be in the film industry in order to let him do it. So there is now a version of She, a 1935 She, that Harryhausen and his team very carefully, beautifully, and magnificently colorized. That's the one you want to get. And if you see both of them, you will realize when you see the color version. And I'm not going to call it colorized. He did. Harryhausen just did a beautiful job. And you will just wonder why they didn't do this in color originally, because the film takes on a marvelous added dimension. So I really want to recommend that. The colorized version, the one that Harryhausen is responsible for, is one that you really want to look at. Now, let's go on to, the film itself is 1935. So that brings us up through World War II to 1947, and that's Jean Cocteau's Orpheus. Now, we mentioned this before in our other program. We talked about magical films. Orpheus is an amazing film. Cocteau shot this film right after World War II. Of course, it's black and white. And he used one old Israel camera. They did all the special effects themselves. They did really ingenious special effects. But primarily, the film depends upon its metaphor and its symbolism. It takes place in modern Paris and the outskirts of Paris. And everything is in modern dress, of course. And it's the Orpheus legend. And Orpheus goes down into the underworld and to rescue Eurydice, and looks back, of course, and she looks back, and what do you know the story? But anyway, the symbolism and the magical effects and the atmosphere of this film are just amazing. And as I said, he did it on a budget that it wasn't a shoestring budget. They didn't even have just half a shoestring. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see. And now moving on to a much bigger production a couple of years later was Orson Welles starring in Black Magic, which was a film on Cagliostro, the famous or you might say infamous French sorcerer during the French Revolution and right before the French Revolution. and so Orson Welles played. They played this Cagliostro as a hypnotist with tremendous power. And of course, you can't imagine anybody better than Orson Welles in his prime to play that. And by the way, that film made quite an impression on me because, you know, our magic in the OTA is, we frankly admit, it's all magical based on hypnosis. And I saw Orpheus back when I was in college, and that's, you know, that made a real impression on me. And so that's one to really look at. It's black and white, very powerful film. Now, 1965, The Saragossa Manuscript, oh boy. This was done in Poland. It's black and white again. It runs for about 4 hours. It's a long film. It is based upon Jan Potocki's 1841 Decameron-type novel called The Saragossa Manuscript, which is one of the most mysterious, boulderized and lost and recovered and plagiarized and everything. This novel, The Saragossa Manuscript, is absolutely fascinating, and it contains a great deal of really, really significant magical lore. By the way, we have an epitome of the occult stories from it in the Seventh Ray, our present issue, the Seventh Ray. That's the Green Ray, number 3. So you can read about it there. But the film is the Polish film is really, really good. Of course, it's subtitled. And Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, they were instrumental in getting this reproduced and on DVD and everything, and I really, really recommend this film. And now let's talk about let's venture into Lovecraft a little bit here with our friend Roger Corman. Everybody loves Roger Corman. Roger Corman's the guy who said he made 100 films in Hollywood and never lost a dime. Well, that's not exactly true, because Roger Corman and his brother risked everything they had, house and everything they could mortgage and pawn, to do a film called The Intruder with Bill Shatner on kind of an anti-KKK film. Right back when that was, when the FBI was, and the Freedom Riders and the FBI and the KKK were all getting at it. They did this film and put everything they had into it, and it was a good film, and completely bellied up. I mean, so when Roger Corman says he made 100 films in Hollywood and never lost a dime, he's talking about the 100 films he made that were made for commercial purposes. However, The Haunted Palace, Roger Corman's Haunted Palace, it was made to make money, and it did, but oh boy, this is a good one. Now, it's The Haunted Palace by Edgar Allan Poe, but that's, anyhow, it is, because the poem is in the beginning, and there is a palace, and it's haunted all right. But what it really is The Case of Charles Dexter Ward by Howard Phillips Lovecraft, which is a Lovecraft novel. And kind of an unusual Lovecraft novel in the sense that this is a novel about a dark alchemist. Now, Lovecraft didn't usually, he had his own version of mythos, and he had his own version of demonology and everything else. So he didn't usually get into what we would call the Western tradition. But in this case, he did. And he really did his research. And so the case of Charles Dexter Ward, we have I won't say modern day, because the story is supposed to take place in the late 1800s. But, however, this Charles Dexter Ward is a sinister alchemist. And, of course, is doing what you usually do in a Lovecraft stories. He's sacrificing maidens to horrible beasties that live in glowing pools down in deep cellars under haunted palaces. And, oh, boy. I mean, now, in this particular film, which, by the way, follows the story rather well, and the screenplay is by Charles Beaumont. Of course, he's a really good science fiction writer. And it stars as Dexter Will himself, the incomparable Vincent Price, who is assisted by Lon Chaney Jr. So this is really one that you want to see. If you're into Lovecraft, this is one you want to see. It's called The Haunted Palace. It's Roger Corman with Vincent Price and Lon Chaney Jr., and it's available on DVD, and get a new nice copy of it, and that's a good one. Now, something that I will mention is that there is another. In fact, I think there are two more film versions of A Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Two more floating around. Don't bother. The Haunted Palace is that's the version of The Case of Charles Dexter Ward that you want to look at. Listen, in my opinion, anyway. Now, that brings us right on along to another pair of films done by the incomparable Vincent Price, which I really, really like. The Abominable Dr. Fibes. I think The Abominable Dr. Fibes was 1971, and the sequel, Dr. Fibes Rises Again, comes out in 1972, which means that they were shooting them pretty close together. And he was a number of the same people. Now, this is a case in which the sequel, Dr. Fibes Rises Again, is just as good, and some people like it better than the original Dr. Fibes. So the two of them are a match set. And I would mention the same thing. Well, I was going to mention Hellraiser and the sequel to Hellraiser, Hellraiser 2. It's the same situation. Both films are equally good, and they should be bought and viewed as a set. In Dr. Fibes, just without a spoiler here, Dr. Fibes is, this takes place right back at the turn of the last century, in the Victorian age kind of thing. And, actually more Edwardian. Edwardian because the production design of both of the Fibes films, the production design is one of the greatest parts of the movie. I mean, this was what makes a good movie into a great movie, is the production design, and this is all done in Art Deco. And there's you art and architecture buffs, and those of you who are interested in that. Oh, this is just, I mean, the Art Deco, everything is a beautiful symphony of Art Deco. And the entire way that the Fibes films are done, the style and the direction, the style, and everything just fits together perfectly. It's kind of tongue in cheek, but it has a haunting mood. And Dr. Fibes is this tragic figure whose face was terribly disfigured in this automobile accident, in which his young wife died and didn't. Well, she died. She died on the operating table later. So he blames all the doctors that worked on her. And he goes out to kill each one of them in a very, very creative sort of way, using the Bible in one thing or another. But again, I don't want to spoil it for you. The second one, he goes to Egypt and still trying to resurrect his Victoria, and he speaks with this respirator. You know, his voice is ruined, and so he has this voice box. And then he has, he plays the organ, of course, and then he has this absolutely beautiful, statuesque lady, young woman, Volnavia. And Volnavia assists him in all his diabolical designs, but she never says anything. She just stands there in a different fashionable outfit for every scene and brings in horrible devices and all this stuff. And she's a tableau. And he speaks in this voice, "Yes, Volnavia, my beautiful, my Victoria was killed by these people, and we will have our revenge." I mean, this is, you got to see the Dr. Fives films. They're wonderful. And so, let's see. My list here is kind of got a lot of inserts in it, one thing or another. Okay. 1973, yeah, following right along, right after Dr. Fives, one of my favorite, and this is where a lot of people disagree with me, but this is one of my favorite weird movie producers, Alejandro Jodorowsky. Now, Alejandro right now is about 95 years old, and he teaches tarot over in Paris. And there's a story behind that. I mean, why he teaches tarot in Paris. But anyway, Alejandro Jodorowsky is most famous for a wild, crazy midnight movie called El Topo. Now, El Topo is very interesting. This is about a kind of a Zen gunfighter in Mexico back in around 1900 who, Jodorowsky is a student of magic and a student of sorcery and Kabbalah but primarily a Gurdjieffian. That's where he's at, primarily Gurdjieff. And he wanted to make a film in which his character would select a number of very prominent people who had planets prominent in their horoscopes, that their character was reflected by these planets, and they would each have a business that would reflect this character and whatever. And for instance, there's a lady who has Mars very prominently in her chart, and so she is an arms manufacturer. And then the chief of police, he's Saturnian, and you can imagine what the guy who has Venus is. You can imagine that one. But anyway, he gets all these people, the guru, to give up all their money and all their work and takes them up on a quest to climb the Holy Mountain. And all the things they go through and all the symbolism and everything. And this is a very, very thought-provoking film, and I won't spoil it by telling you how it turns out or anything like that, but it's very, very unusual. And kind of, in some ways, it's kind of similar to Far Beyond Lemuria, but I don't claim that I was influenced by it, because their only copy about halfway through when we were doing Beyond Lemuria, which took us 2.5 years, about halfway through it, I got a terrible VHS copy of Jodorowsky's Holy Mountain. I couldn't even hardly see anything in it. It had been so many generations off, and so really, we had the script, and we were already doing what we were doing. But there are some similarities between Beyond Lemuria and Jodorowsky's Holy Mountain. However, the fact that I couldn't get a decent print of Holy Mountain is part of the story here, because Jodorowsky had an angel man by the name of Klein, who was his executive producer, so to speak, the guy who was putting up the money for him to do his films. And Klein, after, man, they weren't making very much money. And after Holy Mountain, Klein wanted Jodorowsky to do The Story of O. Well, Jodorowsky's pretty outrageous filmmaker. I mean, he doesn't have anything against nudity, against all kinds of kinky stuff, which he did. But what Klein didn't know was that Jodorowsky had, meanwhile, down in Mexico, gotten with a female, with a lady brujo down there, and had become a feminist. Well, not a feminist, not exactly, but he became a goddess worshiper. And so when Klein says, well, cool, now you're going to do The Story of O for me. We're going to make money. Well, those of you who don't know about The Story of O, anyway, which has been filmed a couple of times, by the way, The Story of O is a very, very sadomasochistic thing, the degradation of women is the major theme in that. And Klein didn't realize that Jodorowsky had meanwhile become very much of a goddess worshiper. And so the result was that Klein got all these New York bankers together and everything, and got Jodorowsky to fly over from Paris, and they were going to get this thing ready and finance it. And Jodorowsky got all the way up to the door of the suite in New York, and turned around and walked out and walked back, got on the plane and left. Klein at that point said, well, working this town, I better than any other. And so he suppressed all of Jodorowsky's films, and you couldn't get. The only one you could get was a three generation knockoff VHS made in Korea with Serbo-Croatian subtitles, if you were lucky. Klein used, but finally Klein's son actually, and he forgave Jodorowsky, and just a few years ago, and now you can get all of Jodorowsky's films in a nice gift box set, and they're really good. So The Holy Mountain and El Topo and all the rest of them, I really, really recommend them, and they're beautifully done. They've all been remastered, and they're just really, really beautifully done. So that's the story on The Holy Mountain. Now, let's go to another little classic here that I really, really like, that everybody seems to have forgotten. And that is The Wicker Man. Now, we haven't forgotten it because it just got remade and ruined. They wrote the remake, ruined it. The Wicker Man is a very unusual film. It's 1971, I believe. And it starred Edward Woodward and Christopher Lee. And The Wicker Man is a pagan, it's a pagan film. And it takes place on an island off the coast of Scotland. And the idea is that they lure this very, very priggish police constable, who is also a deacon in the Episcopal Church, out there to this island, and they sacrifice him. But there's a lot more to it than that. And the film is lighthearted in some ways and very deep in others, and it's very, very tastefully done. And there are pagan British country dancing the British rural country dancing traditions are very, very, very well presented. It's a film that if you're at all interested in the pagan movement, this is a classic. Yes. Some people, of course, think that it's a horror film because poor Edward Woodward, he gets burned up in the end. But that's kind of symbolic. It doesn't bother me that much because I realize that they're using this to get a point across. And the best did. Now, Wicker Man was just recently remade, and and it was terrible. It was just they remade it with somebody in a feminist wicker cult up in Vancouver or something like that. It was supposed to be the name was really awful. So the original program is an absolute classic, and that's one that you're really on there. If you are, you're going to look at it. What I really, really like, I think this, I can't quite get a date on this thing, but I think it's around 1980, is called The Lair of the White Worm. You might want to write that down. The Lair of the White Worm. Now, The Lair of the White Worm is based upon a novel by Bram Stoker, the same guy that wrote Dracula. The novel is not that good. The film is vastly better than the novel. The film is by Ken Russell, who just died a month or so ago. Ken Russell is a very avant-garde British filmmaker. And The Lair of the White Worm takes place in England. It's kind of a comedy, but it's a dark comedy. And it's a comedy Russell's films all seem to have this. It has this fearful edge to it. There's an under edge of fear and mystery and kind of a haunting quality underlying the comedic elements are superficial, let me put it that way. And the idea here is that the white worm lives in the caverns under this castle and has been there ever since before Roman times and whatever. And the white worm is a very malefic monster and influences the people who live in the castle. As I say, I'm not going to spoil it for you. But this Lair of the White Worm, now the story, and it's not very well written, as I said. I'm not recommending the novel, but it did have an influence on Lovecraft, because this white worm is a kind of an elder creature. It's not human, and this did so. The Lair of the White Worm is one that you might want to put in your collection. It's available on DVD, of course. And now that leads us to the discussion of the more recent, very good Lovecraft cat classics. Now, these films, and by the way, a lot of movies made on Lovecraft stories. Brian Yunz has done a pretty good job of some of them, and I'm not gonna mention. I'll mention a couple of them. I think that the Reanimator is good. That's worth looking at. That's the Reanimator, of course, is Herbert West. But what's really, really, really important in this Lovecraft thing here is the films that have been created by a genius by the name of Sean Branagh. And he is the director and the writer and director over at an organization called the Howard Phillips Lovecraft Historical Society. They have a logo. They put the letters HPLHS on a blimp, and they have this blimp flying around it, flying around the globe of the world. It's kind of like the old RKO. Logo where they had the little plane that flew around the world. So they had this old dirigible. I mean, it's not a blimp, it's a dirigible. HPLHS, and that's their opening logo. But they have produced two really amazing films. Now, the first one they did, was came out in 2005 called The Call of Cthulhu. Now, this film, actually, it's kind of short. It only goes for about 47 minutes. But that's because it's a silent. It came out in 2005. It's a silent film. And it follows the story, the Lovecraft story, Call of Cthulhu, which came out in the early 1920s. And so they made this film just as if it had been filmed maybe a year after the story was published. And they wanted it to look exactly like it had been filmed in, say, 1926. That's what they wanted it to look like. And they succeeded amazingly. And the special effects that they did, most of the special effects are practical. And what I mean by that, when I say practical special effects, we're so used to CGI these days that we don't even realize that there is a difference between a practical effect and a computer generated effect. Practical effects are when you build something and you make it move mechanically and create an illusion with smoke, with mirrors, with all these various things that you do without using a computer to create a special effect. They did, some of the things they did in this Call of Cthulhu here, I think their documentary, which is, I think, a little bit longer than the film itself, and they'll show you how they did it. I think that's one of the best parts of it, but then I don't want to give you the impression that this is just an exercise in how to make a movie. This is a marvelous piece of work, this little Call of Cthulhu. All silent, and it really is a time machine. It takes you back. And I would suggest you read the story. The way you appreciate the films that Branny and his team make is to read the Lovecraft story first, and then enjoy the film, because they are so intent upon authenticity that whereas other filmmakers, you know, how do we juice this thing up? We're going to get into their next one, which is the one that just came out, and that is 2011, called The Whisperer in Darkness. And that is one of the, oh boy, this Call of Cthulhu was just a warm-up for this one. And The Whisperer in Darkness, and of course that's a Lovecraft story, a short novel. The Whisperer in Darkness is, it came out in 1932 or something like that. So consequently, they thought that the best way to do that would be to make a talkie out of it, make a film as if it had been made in 1933-34. So that's what they did. They made this look like a film had made back in the 1930s, and they succeeded again. They succeeded perfectly. But it's almost too perfect, because the films in those days, sometimes they needed to be modernized. But this one is just, it looks like it really does. You can watch this and you can just think you're back in watching something made back in the 1930s. Now, Whisper in Darkness, the story, without spoiling it, the story is about a college professor who just doesn't believe that that there are these strange things that are supposedly happening up in the backwoods of Vermont. He just doesn't believe that they're really happening, and he's trying to put the whole thing down. And this old fellow's communicating with him from back up there in the hills, and keeps wanting to come back there. And finally, he does go back there. He goes back up into the hills of Vermont, and things go from bad to worse. It finally ends up so bizarre that they keep the suspense going. Now, one of the things that they do, as I say, I really suggest if you're really into this, I really suggest you read Whisper in the Darkness first before you see the film. And that'll make you appreciate it all the more, because you know that in the original story, Lovecraft used he used Stoker's device that Stoker used in Dracula about all these letters back and forth. Oh, he gets a letter from the guy up in Vermont, and then he answers it, and he gets another letter, and he builds it up that way. Well, that's not so good for a film. So they have him on a radio show with Charles Fort debating all of this, but it follows the story. They don't do any violence to the story. They just figure out ways to make it more dramatic. And good screenwriting. I mean, it's an exercise in wonderful screenwriting, because this is how, whenever you take a novel and you turn it into a screenplay, oh boy, it's a whole different ballgame, because, you know, and they do a beautiful job with this and stay right with the story then. But the story goes all the way up to the second act. The end of the second act is the end of Lovecraft's story. But then they go ahead and they write their own third act. Their third act is terrific, and it follows right along with the way the story would have gone. Lovecraft quite often did that. He would just end these stories, you know, on a note, on a sort of a hopeless note, and that would end. And he would sort of let you finish the story in your own mind. Well, in this case, The Whisper in the Darkness, Sean Branagh and the boys, they just went ahead and they finished up. Boy, did they ever finish it up. It was beautiful. And they did do, I'm going to say this much, they did a real topper scene in the end there, where they did use a little CGI, but it was very, very well done. And this is a film, if you're into Lovecraft at all, or again, but you just like really nostalgic, really, really effective magical films, this is one you really, really want to see. And I'll mention, too, because Dave Finnan sent me a copy of a German Lovecraft film, just came out recently. I think it's called Die Fieber, or something like that. Actually, it's based upon Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space. Now, this is an interesting film. I don't think it's much of a four-star effort like The Whisper in the Darkness, but it is very moody, and it's done in black and white, except where The Color Out of Space comes in. And that's one that's interesting, and I just want to mention it, and they're trying to stay very close to the story, except that they moved it from upstate New Hampshire over to Germany, which is okay. But The Whisper in the Darkness, though, is one that really, really, really is terrific. So this is kind of my pick of my favorites, and I really did, as I said, I really recommend the Howard Phillips Lovecraft Call of Cthulhu, The Whisper in the Darkness. I would get the book. And by the way, they have old-time Lovecraft radio shows, too, that they have on CD. So they're really doing a good job. So we covered The Golem, The Magician, She, Cocteau's Orpheus, Orson Welles' Black Magic, The Haunted Palace, which is actually the case of Charles Dexter Ward by Lovecraft, and Dr. Fibes, and Dr. Fibes Rises Again with Vincent Price, The Lair of the White Worm, Ken Russell's film, The Holy Fountain, Alejandro Jodorowsky, The Saragossa Manuscript, and Wicker Man, and those are my particular favorites. And so next week, we have one of the top writers on modern alchemy and the secrets of World War II and the mysterious inventions that were made in secret in World War II and all that. And hopefully we will have Joseph Farrell on to talk about his book, The Philosopher's Stone and the Black Sun. And so we'll look forward to next week. And meanwhile, good magic.